The very first time that you sat down to meditate, do you remember what happened? Can you remember what that was like? I can remember the first time I meditated was in Wat Rampang in Chiang Mai, and sitting down in a place, a kuti, which had the which gloried in the title of the dog box. That was my kuti, and it was called the dog box for one very good reason. I'd been given like 5 minutes or 10 minutes of meditation instructions and then told not to go off and do it and sit for 20 minutes. So there off I went and sat for 20 minutes. And at the end of the 20 minutes I thought, oh, it's not really, nothing really much happened. It was not, it's a bit of a non-event really. But then when sometime during that period when we sat meditation for the first time, both yourselves and myself, and everyone who sits meditation, sometime during that, this little switch gets turned. And little voice says, oh, little voice of pride comes in and says, oh, I'm a meditator now. And you get attached to the fact that you're a meditator. You're proud of the fact that you practice. And this is why each time when we go to sit meditation, we feel this kind of sense of virtue, not because of the actual work that the meditation does, but because we have this kind of identification of ourselves as a meditator, and we think we're somehow bad if we don't meditate and we're good if we do. And so we feel upset and angry with ourselves and down and have kind of self-loathing when we give up our practice and then feel very proud and pleased and happy with ourselves when we do practice. This is the nature of the mind. It's always like that. So this is one thing we have to be very careful of and very watchful for, is this kind of spiritual pride. How long can I sit on the floor without moving? How many hours can I sit meditation? What kinds of austere practices can I do? All of these kinds of things, they get into the heart and they fill us with all kinds of pride in what we're doing, which is not necessarily such a good thing. And so often we come to spiritual practice and we want to do this, we want to do this, we want to do this practice or that practice or whatever it may be. And this doesn't necessarily really come from like an understanding of what we need, an understanding of where is our defilements, where is our problems. Often it comes from a sense of desperation or a sense of restlessness, a sense of lack of contentment with where one is, or a sense of pride that one can do all of these things. And so we all have to try to deal with this kind of pride. I was just chatting with somebody today and remarked that global conference on Buddhism in Singapore a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago now, Ajahn Brahm said in one of his talks that when he was a young monk, he was very proud of himself because he kept Vinaya. He was a good Vinaya monk. And he always used to look down upon and disparage other monks who didn't keep Vinaya. You're bad monks. Bad people. And so this is how it is, isn't it? These are kind of spiritual practices that we do, they make us feel conceited. If we belong to a tradition like we do, like to the forest tradition that regards Vinaya as very important, likes to keep strict Vinaya, we don't use money, we don't eat in the afternoon, we just have one set of robes, we're frugal with the requisites, and we try to observe the letter of the Vinaya rules as best as we can. And, you know, we make sure all our food is offered properly and all of these kinds of things. And so it's very easy to get proud because of that, because we can accomplish that, because it's something that's not easy. And it's something we do have to be careful of. We have to be mindful, we have to be diligent, we have to put effort into. And we have to be honest with ourselves. When we break the rules or break the Vinaya, then have to look into our hearts and understand, why is this so? Where are these defilements coming from? And so, you know, it's something that's not easy to do. Most people find it very difficult to keep this kind of discipline. So we have to watch this kind of pride. Don't think that it's somebody else who's going to feel this, not me. That's not true. The very fact that you might say that is immediately announcing that it is you that's doing it. It's precisely you that's doing it. That's why you're thinking in that way. And so often, especially when we join the Sangha, then it becomes the whole dynamic. This whole dynamic that I'm talking about applies to everyone who sits meditation or who does spiritual practices. They're going to feel like this in some way. And it's funny, but somehow it seems that the spiritual practices that we do, in some ways, they kind of override, or they seem to be more, because we have this pride, they seem to be more important to us than things which other people regard as important. And so our kind of our perception of these kinds of things becomes a bit distorted. And this is something also I've observed both in myself and in others. So we need to be able to, we need to watch these things. And especially, you know, many people here have either decided to ordain or are thinking of it or have been involved with the Sangha. And so this is something that's very important to notice and to watch this kind of, watch this pattern emerging. Because when one takes robes, these kinds of dynamics become turbocharged. They become doubled in strength or quadrupled in strength. And everything becomes much more intense. We have a lot of expectations, both our own inner expectations and also the expectations of others, about how we should be, how we should behave. People expect a certain level of purity and virtue and so on, and if we don't live up to that, then there's something wrong with us. We look down upon ourselves, or others look down on us. And so we quite rightly, we give importance to keeping our standard of conduct, our vinaya, very pure. But, you know, I do notice that sometimes that we lose perspective on that, we lose sight of what's really important. And many examples that I could give. I mean, one, you know, thing is, some general things is I've noticed, for example, that we take a lot of care with things that are our traditional requisites. So, like, you know, we care a lot about, say, our bowl, and you know, we make sure that it's cleaned properly, that it's protected properly and stored properly, and all of these kinds of things, and we make sure that we look after it the right way, and there's a proper way that we do of washing it and drying it and all of these kinds of things. We kind of look after that as one of our duties. And same with other requisites that we have. With our robes or whatever, we make sure that they're patched up and clean and so on and so forth and looked after properly. But then sometimes we forget to extend that care with our requisites to other areas of our life. And sometimes those other areas of our life, in fact, are more important or more significant on a broader scale. But because they're maybe not sort of officially part of the monk's duties, then they're kind of neglected or not so important. You know, so things like looking after the electricity usage in the house. That's a very simple thing. Making sure that we switch off lights when they're not needed, making sure we switch off appliances when they're not needed, making sure we don't use the clothes dryer when it's bright and sunny outside, making sure we don't use the washing machine when we don't have a full load of clothes. We just have a few clothes and we just do them by hand, and these kinds of things. And this is something I think is much more important than, you know, whether you patch your robe because it's got a hole in it which is bigger than the nail of your little finger, and as long as it's one hand span away from the edge of the robe and the hole is bigger than your little finger, then you have to put a patch on it. Well, I think that's a good standard, it's a good thing to do, but it's not nearly as important as actually helping to protect the environment, both protecting the environment and also protecting the funds, the money of the people who offered funds for the use of the Sangha, that's being spent with these things. And so this is where we have to, I think, be very careful. This is just one little example. It's not a profound example, not a particularly exciting example. It's a very boring example, but it's one which we do encounter every day, and one which, you know, the kind of thing that we need to be paying attention to. And as you all know, I'm not one of those people who tries to argue that doing your duties properly is the path to Nibbana, okay? So some monasteries you go into and they'll try to tell you that if you do the core what, the duties of the monk, then, or the duties of a nun, then this is how you'll practice the Eightfold Path and get enlightened. I'm not one of those monks. I don't agree with that teaching, actually. If I look in what the Buddha taught, it seems to me if I analyzed it mathematically, there's like five nikayas, five collections, and then one vinaya. So the vinaya is like 1/6 of what the Buddha taught, and within the vinaya, maybe half of it, or maybe less than half, actually maybe only about 20% or 10% of the vinaya is actually dealing with the duties and the core wants. So that's only about maybe 2%, 1% or 2% of the Buddha's actual teachings are dealing with these kinds of duties. And so I don't think that one can take that 1% or 2% and start to try to say this is the whole of the Eightfold Path and that by doing this you're going to get enlightened. So with due respect to some other teachers who try to teach that way, I think it's got more to do with trying to motivate people to keep their monastery clean than it does to do with actually explaining the Buddha's teachings. After you've been an abbot for a while, you just give no credence to these kinds of things. You know, like I read one teacher who said that working in the kitchen is the very best way to practice mindfulness. This kind of saying, yeah, sure. Likely story. You know, that's a monastery where they couldn't get anyone to work in the kitchen. So it has its place, yeah, doing these things, doing these duties and things, it has its place. It's something we should try to do well. And not neglect, but they're usually things that are very simple. They just needs a little bit of effort and a little bit of awareness and a little bit of mindfulness to do these things, and it's not anything particularly challenging or stunning. It's, you know, it's something which everybody does. Everybody tries to keep their house clean and their business clean or their office clean or whatever they're doing, and try to do the various duties and so on that are appropriate. If you're a dentist, you do the dentist duties. If you're a baker, you do the baker's duties. If you're a mechanic, you do the mechanic's duties. And in every case, you have to try to keep, you're a mechanic, you have to keep your tools in order and in good repair and keep the place clean and make sure you deal with customers who come in and all of these kinds of things. Actually, if you look at the duties, they're not that different from what the monk's duties are, actually. But I don't see a lot of mechanics getting enlightened. Maybe they are, I'm not sure, but I don't actually see it. And so I don't see these things as really being the path to enlightenment as such. It's just part of being a decent, common, ordinary human being. Which is, again, it's not to disparage it, it's just to understand it properly. So you need to remember that these things are, you know, what actually is the point of, what is the point of our life and what we're doing here. I remember Bhante Kesari Dhammananda gave a very nice little example of this one time. He was in, now let me, I'll just see if I can remember this example exactly. I can't remember all the details, but he was in maybe an airport or something like that. And there was a lady at the top of an escalator or the top of the upper floor in the airport who, I think she was changing her shoes or something like that, and her shoe fell off, or something that belonged to her fell off. I think it was her shoe for some reason. And it fell near to where Kesari Dhammananda was at the bottom of the escalator. And so he just picked it up and went up the escalator and gave it to her. And she said, oh my goodness, I didn't know that monks were allowed to touch a lady's shoe. And he said, I didn't do it as a monk, I did it as a human being. So that's quite a telling kind of example, like that somehow that being a monk means, there's this expectation that being a monk means you can't just do ordinary, simple, kind things. And I think that's very sad. It's very sad, and it's, you know, we can see how a lot of these expectations get turned around. Actually, if we look in the vineyards, the expectation is exactly the opposite. It's exactly that the monks are supposed to be. The monks and the nuns, of course, are supposed to be doing these acts of kindness and goodness and helping and all of these kinds of things. And so often we find that rules which are actually meant for the monks and nuns get turned around and become rules for lay people. Because one example is when monks and nuns go for alms round, that they're supposed to have bare feet unless their feet are cracked or they have some kind of injury or something. And but in Thai custom, then it becomes the rule that the lay people have to have bare feet, which is completely the other way around from what the rule is. So it's that the lay people now has to be humble offering to the monks, rather than the idea being that the monks have to be humble to receive the food. And completely turned upside down. And I could relate countless examples of this kind of thing. And so, you know, another example being that the monks and nuns have a rule prohibiting using luxurious seats. And so we're supposed to be content with a simple kind of seat or place to sit on. And but if you and there was a special allowance to have a high seat for teaching the Dhamma on. But if you go to a lot of monasteries, what you see is that the monks will be sitting on like couches and very expensive lounge suites, while the lay people are sitting on the floor. And that's exactly what the Vinaya says that they shouldn't be happening. It says that these kind of expensive and luxurious seating should be what lay people are using, and the monks should be sitting on the floor. And on and on and on it goes. And could keep going on for some time. But these, I think you get the idea that these things are all an expression of spiritual pride. If you look and see what kinds of defilements are there, they're all some kinds of spiritual pride. It's all come from kind of feeling that, you know, I'm special somehow. You know, because I'm the monk, I'm special. And you see it happening very early on, you know. It's quite common. You see, for example, when people come into the monastery and then, you know, maybe someone gets appointed to be the head Anagarika. So you might become the number one Anagarika, and then they're like really kind of, and then they start bossing the other Anagarikas around, you know. And you can sort of see this kind of working its way all the way up to the top, you know, this kind of pattern. And you think, you know, is this really what's going on? I mean, Giles told me the story when he was in Bodhinyana a few years ago, and one of the fellows, there's a few long-term lay people staying there, and one of the fellows who I know sort of saying to Giles, oh, you know, this other fellow, you know, he's not pulling his weight, he's not doing enough work, you know, and then you and this other guy are doing all the work instead. You shouldn't be doing all the work for this other guy who's being slack, because then you're just covering for him and you give him an excuse for keeping on slacking off. And no one's ever going to stop him from actually getting on and doing the work that he's going to do. So you should slack off as well. That's what he's saying. So if you know, you're kind of letting the side down, it's like a kind of union thing. If he's slacking off, everyone's got to slack off just as much. And then once everyone slacks off, that then Ajahn Brahm will have to intervene. Ajahn Brahm will have to come along and he'll have to tell that guy off, yeah, then we'll really get him, you know. And Giles has said, well, I quite like working in the kitchen and helping out. I don't mind if I do a bit of extra work. No, you can't do that, you know, you're just giving him the excuse to keep on slacking off. Well, I think it's good merit to work in the kitchen, you know, and to do a bit of extra chores out there. So there's this kind of tussle going on, you know. And of course, this is that blemishes that the Buddha was talking about in this very beautiful sutta. And, you know, that's one of those kinds of blemishes which actually is mentioned in there, is talking about this thing of inequality, which is this perception. We have this perception of unfairness. When things maybe are unequal, and the world isn't unfair, it is unequal. Deal with it, you know. And it's like, so what? And this is in Christianity, in the Gospels, they have this is a very beautiful story of the prodigal son. And for those of you who weren't brought up going to Mass every Sunday, like myself, then the story briefly goes that the rich man had two sons, and one son was very well behaved and always did the work that he was required to do. The other son was very badly behaved. And then eventually the badly behaved son just went off, took the money from the father and went off and spent it all, wasted it all, lived the kind of a loose life and spent it all on drink and gambling and all of these kinds of things. And meanwhile the good son was staying behind on the farm and working every day and doing the right thing. And then eventually the bad son, who's called the prodigal son, ran out of money and was in despair, and eventually he came back to his father's home and asked for forgiveness. And the father was so happy and rejoicing about this, he ordered that they have a great celebration and that they kill the fatted calf. The special celebratory calf should be killed. And they have a big barbecue in honor of the prodigal son. And of course the good son was really pissed off. He's like, how are you doing? I've been here all these years doing exactly the right thing and working hard every day. And he's gone off and been a wastrel and just wasted all this money and everything. And he's the one who gets the celebration. Yeah, he's thinking there's something unfair in that. But again, that's just how life is, isn't it? Yeah? And so sometimes we maybe feel like that. We feel like we're doing all the right things and everything, but somebody else is getting all the privileges or whatever. And so we tend to look at these things in a very narrow way. Everyone will get your reward, don't worry about it. Sooner or later, Doing good never goes unpaid. You don't have to worry about these things. You don't have to concern yourself. You don't have to ask, when's my paycheck coming? Paycheck comes when you become an arahant. That's when you get your paycheck. Well, even though not even when you become an arahant, when you're an arahant and then you pass away into parinibbana, that's when you get your paycheck. Okay, so don't worry about it. And so of course we try to, you know, treat people fairly and do the right thing and so on and so forth, but you never do that 100%. You know, you can never treat people exactly the same because people are different. People have different capacities to work. People have different skills. They have different things to contribute and everything. And so sometimes, you know, have all different dynamics and different energies going on that we're dealing with all the time in a community. It gets very complex. And so our response, what we have to do is just be responding out of kindness. Responding out of, first of all, out of compassion. Make that our first concern. To put aside what do I want to do? Not to be thinking, what do I want to do? And just to be thinking, what do they want to do? What's good for them? What's good for the sisters? What's good for the monks? What's good for the lay people staying here? What can I do that would be helpful? What can I do that's extra? What can I do that's that little bit extra that would be a kind thought that would save somebody else the trouble of having to do that? Where can I go out of my way just a little bit to try to help out these people out of gratitude for everything everyone's doing, out of gratitude for the monks who are staying here, helping support the community and practicing so well, keeping very good vinaya, and you know, the monks here, very, very good practice. It's very rare to find a community of bhikkhus like this. And we've heard some stories in the last few days of bhikkhus who are not well practiced and not inspiring. But that's not the case here. Here we do have monks who are very, very well practiced, very inspiring. They keep very good vinaya. They're intent on seclusion. They're intent on meditation. They have a sincere interest and love of the Buddha's teachings. So this is something that should be very inspiring and is worthy of respect. Not just because someone happens to be wearing a robe, but because someone's actually doing what those people in robes are supposed to be doing. And the same with the sisters here, with the nuns. It's also a very beautiful thing to see that we have nuns in this community willing to renounce, willing to go forth, let behind their families and attachments and devote themselves to the Buddha's teachings. It's something very, very rare and very beautiful. And as we all know, the extra difficulties and problems that women have in ordaining and so on, especially within the Theravada tradition. And so we have to have that special care and concern and appreciation for their courage and commitment to be able to do this. And of course all the wonderful lay people in the monastery doing the cooking for us, helping out with all kinds of things, just shopping and ditch digging and all of these things. And so we can always, there's so many things to be grateful for. So many things we see around us, the community is growing and maturing and so on. And so many things that we can appreciate and have gratitude for. So this is the way that we should be using our mind. And so, you know, I always think it's much nicer not to be doing things out of a sense of duty, out of a sense of, well, I have to do it. But more to be doing things out of a sense of inspiration, a sense of, I really want to do this. I really feel like I would love to be able to do something extra. I remember when I was staying at Wat Manachat, and I first arrived as a layperson before I even became an Anagarika. So only I'd been there a couple of weeks. And we had quite a nice little group of lay people there at that time, and including people who'd been around the scene a lot longer than I had. And then we, you know, we were talking one night and we said, we all had this feeling of such incredible gratitude for the opportunity that we'd been offered there, and to have the Sangha there and the teachings and the accommodation and everything. And so we wanted to do something to give back to the monastery. And so we sort of conceived this little plan, and we got a talk of Ajahn Sumedho's, and someone chose a good talk of Ajahn Sumedho's, and we went into Ubon and found a tape duplicating place. This was before the digital era. And found a tape duplicating shop, and we made, I think, 100 or so copies of this tape. One of the lay women drew up a nice little cover, photocopied it, put it in, someone edited the talk, we did it, we made it, and we offered 100 copies of the talk to the Sangha to give away as a Dhamma Dana. And I remember Ajahn Pasano was very touched. He said he'd never seen this happen before in the monastery. He'd never seen a group of lay people get organized to do these things in that way. And so this is how I've always felt. It's just this incredible, this opportunity that we have. What can we do? Not just to get by and to do what we have to do, but to really offer something special and something extra. What can we look out for? Not to imposing our own agenda and to be, you know, getting people to do what we want, but to really looking what do they need? What can I really help with? And to do things that maybe no one's going to notice, no one's going to recognize, no one's going to praise you for or hold you up in the Sangha and extol your virtues for anything like this. But just these little things that make life living together so much more happy and comfortable. So this is very important to think like this, a very beautiful way to overcome the defilements. So this is my little talk for you this evening. I offer this to you for your reflection and amusement. And anyone has any comments or questions, you're most welcome.
Svākāto bhagavata dhammo dhamma namassāmi. Sapatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅghaṁ namassāmi.